This is Mae Brussel. It's the second half. This half hour is the second half of World Watchers, program number 802. I got a call on the talk show part of my program requesting that I give information about the relocation of the Indians that was in the news quite a bit in the summer, and we haven't heard much about it. And the person who called wanted me to discuss the companies that were behind the relocation and the necessity for moving them. The Indians up in Flagstaff, the Navajo Hopi Indians, moved them out of their native territory. And so I just wanted to make one comment about it because I did have a broadcast on World Watchers the past summer. There's a book called Global Reach that describes Richard Nixon's activities in Chile and the necessity for Americans to, in quotes, protect American interests. And one reason the government was overthrown in Chile and Allende was murdered was because of companies such as Anaconda Copper, Kennecott Copper, and American multinational corporations that would not want to pay the wages of a labor union to native populations in countries such as Chile. And when you have somebody like Mr. Pinochet in power with a dictatorship, you can pay any price you want. If they don't work, just don't put them to work. The multinationals want profits for their investment, and they're willing to put in the dictators to make sure that those prices stay that way. Now, in 1974, there were plans to move the American Indians that were put into effect in the summer of 1986. In 1974, there was the largest order for relocation in the United States since World War II, when the Japanese were put away in the concentration camps. It was called Public Law 93-531. It involved the final deportation of over 10,000 Navajo people from 1,500 square miles of Hopi partitioned lands. The Black Mesa, the Four Corners in Arizona, is rich in coal, uranium. Big Mountain is the center of the lands that are to be cleared out, and they're moving these people out. And most of them are going to Flagstaff, Arizona, and cities. They're not used to being in cities. They've been self-sufficient. It will cost taxpayers, it is costing, $1.5 billion to move the Indians out of their lands where they've been for many, many years. And then the profit will be given to the companies that have uranium and coal. We'll pay for their moving, and then the companies can come in. It's like having buildings bulldozed down, and then you come in and take the lots. There are over 23 mining corporations involved. Attorney John Oyden, O-Y-D-E-N, who set up the relocation programs, one of the main offices, got $1 million in fee, and he represented both the Indians and the mining company. The largest company recognized is the Peabody Coal. Bechtel Corporation, of which George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger and other cabinet people are involved, and former president and chairman of Bechtel is also John McCone of ITT and CIA. 15% of Peabody is owned by Bechtel Corporation. The board of Peabody includes Stanley Hiller of the Crocker Bank, who supports South African government, David Packard, well-known from Hewlett-Packard, the Defense Department, who's former Secretary of Defense under Richard Nixon, D.E. Skinner on the board of General Electric. He built the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant, and the Fluor Corporation owns 10% of Peabody Coal. That was founded by CIA Director John McCone. The uranium companies involve Kerr McGee, Mobil, Conoco, United Nuclear, Exxon, and as I say, there are 22 companies. So that maybe answers the question somebody asked me about who was behind the relocation. And it's always, of course, for money. You might know that. And it was. And there are some people that will make quite a bit once the Indians are moved off. I have mentioned Franklin Camper as being under indictment and at trial down in Riverside, California, the terrorist who ran a school in Alabama and trained Sikhs, later wanted, charged with attempting to murder an Indian who was having medical surgery in Louisiana, and they're linked to the Air India airplane crash and the air bombing that took place. The bomb went off in Japan at the airport. It wasn't up in the air yet. Franklin Camper was found guilty this past week, April 14th, 1987, in the L.A. Times. And as with stories on Western goals or well-known stories, this didn't make the wire service. It only meant, if you live in Los Angeles, it went on the L.A. Times. The article says a federal grand jury Monday convicted Franklin Camper of firebombing two cars after two Orange County private school operators hired him. These are nursery and for small children, the teachers do firebombing and hire the notorious Franklin Camper. Camper, 40, owner of Ueytown, Alabama School for Mercenaries, was tried on the same charges. Last fall, a mistrial was declared. The jury was unable to reach a decision. Monday, after a four-week trial and 3 days of deliberation, they convicted Camper of conspiring, racketeering, using destructive device during a crime. The jury deadlocked on two counts of arson, one of possessing a destructive device regarding the firebombings. A Vietnam veteran who claimed to have performed numerous undercover missions for the United States government, which he did for the FBI and the CIA, testified at both trials that his associates destroyed the cars while he was asleep. "It's not over yet," Camper said when he left the court. William Hedgeworth, an instructor at Camper School, was convicted of four counts, as was Camper's girlfriend, Leanne Folk. She was acquitted on five counts of which she was charged. Federal prosecutors said both Camper and Hedgeworth face at least 10 years, perhaps as long as 35 years in prison. That would be very nice. Let's see if that happens. But being a federal agent, it may be that they want to lock him up because things are getting too hot, and he does connect to a lot of other violences. Now, the last few weeks, I have mentioned the people that have been rounded up, who are in jail, who are having trials, the terrorists, terror from the right, which some group or body is going to have to someday say, yes, it's from the right and not from the leftists. At least this is a start. Camper was convicted, and let's see what his sentence is. The sentencing will be pretty soon. The women who hired these gentlemen, they plead guilty to conspiracy, and last month one of them was sentenced to 7 years in prison. Well, there goes the nursery school, and the other one's going to be sentenced April 27th. So it'll be interesting to see someday just how many nursery schools could go to Franklin Camper and have him bomb former teachers if they didn't like them. It seemed like a lot of overkill for two nursery school teachers. I don't know how it came about, but it did. Now, this is April the 20th, 1987, and I can't help but say happy birthday to Adolf Hitler. He may be still alive. I mentioned about a month ago that a Dr. Robert Dorion, director of the Ministry of Solicitor General of Quebec, presented a paper in Canada about his findings to the American Academy of Forensic Sciences that Hitler's teeth were not identical to the ones of the body found in the bunker, and there have been researchers working on this for years. I seem to be satisfied or settle easily with the news account on CNN News that the Führer died in January 1987 in Mendoza, Argentina. I have a very good friend who's a Hitler watcher. He says that would be too easy, that the Fourth Reich had promised Adolf Hitler on his birthday next year when he is 100 years old that they would give him the world. So we'll wait and see if he has the world by then or not. But Mr. Schlickelgruber, whose name was then changed to Alois Hitler, the father, and Adolf Hitler, the son, he had five siblings, incidentally. His sister died in 1950. But that's the way the cookie crumbles. Hitler may or may not be alive now, I'm not sure. I think it would be possible to die when you're 98 and three quarters. The San Francisco Examiner had an article just this last December 31st, a New Year's Eve article. The Axis of World War II takes the UN Council seats. This is the first time since World War II that Japan, Italy, and West Germany became members of the UN Security Council. So Hitler lives in that sense, and Hitler lives in the sense that Mr. Waldheim was able to keep his records locked up in the UN building until he was president of the UN for many years and then president of Austria. There's a new book out by a person. I think these books are totally ridiculous. His name is Dennis Brio, and there's a review, Extraordinary Care, and it's about Adolf Hitler, Elvis Presley, and Howard Hughes, who were impossible patients and had the difficulty taking care of them because of their personality quirks. This is just a lot of BS. I'd like to do maybe several broadcasts on Presley and Hitler and certainly Howard Hughes again to show you these are to reinforce the ideas that they almost had a death wish, and that's why they were mistreated or their bodies were mistreated which is part of a series of books, talk about accuracy in media, that are nothing but disinformation. Hitler lives in the sense of those files still locked up in the United Nations that I have talked about the last few weeks, and I think I'll bring up every single week. The files are parked at 345 Park Avenue South in New York City, and there is a list of 36,000 Nazi war criminals, 36,810 there were, and now we know who three were, so that's 807. And Hitler lives as long as those names are locked up and protected. And there was an article I mentioned, the Kansas City Times, and one the New York Times, titled War Crimes Files Belong to History, and Hitler Lives as Long as Those Continue. I cited last week the book by Phyllis Schlafly, the far-right person who wrote a book, Kissing Her on the Couch, and she refers to Fritz Kramer and Dr. William Yandel Elliott and the influences behind Henry Kissinger. Hitler Lives, if you don't go into Fritz Kramer, Henry Kissinger, Dr. Elliott, and Alexander Haig, certainly those four, Hitler Lives. I have many good books on Rudolf Hess, and Hess is going to be released, I understand. He's 92 years old. They're going to let him out of Spandau Prison. One book I have is edited by John Rawlings Reese. He helped write it. It's called The Case of Rudolf Hess, and Reese runs the Tavistock Clinic in Great Britain. I often wondered if John Reese was the son of John Rawlings Reese. I never have checked it out. Would you believe that? That's my project for 1987, because John Reese came to this country just at the time John Kennedy was killed, and worked his way right from, he was from Great Britain, and worked his way right from his trip in to the United States into the organization known as Western Goals, working for the secretary. Louise Reese married her. John Reese married Louise, and Secretary of Senator Joe McCarthy, who released Fritz Kramer out of the Dachau prison in 1946-47. And I wonder if, it's silly to ask so many times, I've got to look up and see if John Rawlings Reese of Tavistock Clinic is related to John Reese of Western Goals, who then went on to work for Carl Spitz Channel. And the Reese people are associated with covert action, counterintelligence, publishing books with the names of the liberal, the left, for police departments or goon squads to visit your homes and reveal who you are in case they want to damage your homes or in case, I suppose, there's another Crystal Knight. Now, John Rawlings Reese wrote the story of Rudolf Hess landing in Scotland in May of 1941, going to the home of Duke of Hamilton, and he brought a letter with him or letters with him. Rudolf Hess was Hitler's deputy. He was the leader of the Nazi Party. He was a Reich minister without portfolio. He was a member of the Ministerial Council for the Defense of the Reich. He was the secret cabinet counsel for Hitler. And he arrived unannounced in Scotland to the home of Mr. Hamilton. There's another good book I have, the story behind Hess's flight to Britain, and I'll share more of that with you in a week or two. But his trip was so secret that Winston Churchill and the British government refused to discuss it. And Rudolf Hess was put in the hands of seven American psychiatrists, American and British, and they could do a good job on him between 1941 and 1945. When he stood trial at the Nuremberg trials, he was, of course, given the sentence that put him in Spandau prison for the rest of his life. But while at Spandau, he didn't see his wife or his son for 28 years, and there's a lot of reason to believe that the man there was substituted once he was through with the trial, and that the real Rudolf Hess was allowed to leave. And if he was allowed to leave, he set up with Martin Bormann all the South American contacts, and with Otto Skorzeny, that they would need to turn over the Reich to Adolf Hitler on his 100th birthday. The magazine Gung Ho in 1986, August 86, had an article about Rudolf Hess, and it tells about his speaking with Speer when they were at Spandau Prison together before Albert Speer was released. And the article says, what is certain is that Rudolf Hess, like G. Gordon Liddy of a later era, never lost faith in his master or recanted. As he told Colonel Byrd decades after 1941, I would not have missed the opportunity of serving under Adolf Hitler as his deputy. I was a dedicated man. The figure of the Führer will stand like a beacon over the centuries, and he will be honored as one of the greatest pathfinders and benefactors of mankind. G. Gordon Liddy is moving some headquarters for his international snooping, or whatever you want to call it, up to Silicon Valley, which is very dangerous considering Mr. Reed Irvine has targeted that area as being important. And the news from David Emery and Niptuck, and he hasn't mentioned Mae Brussel, but I'm sure they know, because over that radio station, putting Gigor and Liddy up there in Silicon Valley is really dangerous. And Oliver North follows this same line. The people he works with have the same principle. You don't have to worry about that. And Adolf Hitler lives in the White House, the Oval Office of Ronald Reagan. There was an article in the Miami Herald about John Kohler, the member of the Hitler Youth who was turned down as a communications director of the White House. And the title of the article was March the 11th, 1987, AIDS Exit Called a Blow to Reagan, Seen as a Setback to a Strong Image. And the gist of the article is that in the rare departure from normal when the White House hired Kohler, he had been personally endorsed for the job by the president, by Nancy Reagan, by Charles Z. Wick, and Robert Bowman has Wick on that lunatic fringe, you know. It was unusual to remove him from his job when they found out he was part of Hitler Youth. And the article says from the Miami Herald that the White House was disappointed because if they had John Kohler there, Ronald Reagan would have a strong image. Well, that's identical to Ronald Reagan going to Bitburg, standing at the graves of the Waffen-SS and projecting to the world that you are forgiven. Hitler was probably right in doing what he did, and I'm going to recognize you young people dying for a cause. That's the mentality of Hess, of Liddy, of Oliver North, and the White House, according to this story, was disappointed because we have a very image-conscious president, and it bothered him that a person of the Hitler Youth couldn't give the president a strong image. He wanted a stronger image by having John Kohler there as communication director of the White House. And Hitler lives, of course, in the Wall Street Journal just today, April 20th. The United States will now begin gene-altered animal patents. It cites a certain company that already had been experimenting on animals, and by genetically altering them, they put some rabbit genes into a rat and grew a giant rat. So as of now, outside the laboratory, in the animal laboratory, the animals will be experimented, all animals other than humans. This was started by Embragene under the aegis of Ohio State University, Ohio State's Edison Animal Biotechnology Center. The center director is Thomas Wagner, who is one of the scientists who inserted the rabbit gene to get the huge giant mouse. So as of this point, they can start altering animals. And I understand in Japan, they're already getting a genetically altered hepatitis vaccine in silkworms and using silkworms to clear these matters. And as far as chemical and food altering, I have many articles. I should be doing one of those a week for you to update you on these. The Wall Street Journal today said, court clears the delay of a ban on tainted mango imports. And the gist of the article is the Environmental Protection Agency wanted to stop mangoes with pesticide that could cause cancer. But the Environmental Protection Agency says we won't stop them coming in this country till after September the 30th because the State Department wants to soften the impact. The mangoes are grown in Mexico, Haiti, Belize, and Guatemala. And the EPA, rather, is objecting to the State Department. They said the first interest should be to protect American citizens, not foreign policy. And the State Department said, we will consider foreign policy. They can send them until they figure out what to do as far as selling their products, probably to third world countries. I consider us a third world country. They're sending us those foods. So the State Department wins that we can get mangoes until September 30th from countries using pesticides that could cause cancer. Also, the Environmental Protection Agency eased the restriction in Portland, Oregon. The judge said that they can use Dinoseb, which is a pesticide that causes birth defects and sterility. And this is dangerous. It says on green peas, snap beans, cucurbits, and canneberries in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho that they can put this on the food. It affects the health and safety of farmers, families, and unborn children. The EPA protested a court order easing the ban. It goes on to say the EPA has allowed the chemical use on dry peas, lentils, and chickpeas in parts of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. So what you're getting is a chemical, Dinoseb, in this case herbicide, that can cause sterility and birth defects. Keep in mind the vegetarians. I'm a vegetarian. A source of protein, a good source of protein in these matters, is dry peas, lentils, and chickpeas. And the EPA says, yeah, you can put this chemical, if I'm reading it properly, Dinoseb, they've eased it on these particular foods. And the purpose of being a vegetarian is to get away from the kinds of things that are put into meats and animals. That's my reason. The article goes on to say last year, 7 to 11 million pounds of this chemical, this herbicide, Dinoseb is a herbicide and serves as a fungicide and an insecticide. 7 to 11 million pounds were sold annually since for quite a few years by 80 companies, including Uniroyal Chemical Company, a unit of Uniroyal Cedar Chemical Corporation, the U.S. unit of Host AG of West Germany. West Germany sending a insecticide to this country, making an insecticide that causes sterility and damage to birth defects to affecting unborn children, coming into beans and food products that vegetarians eat, in dry peas, chickpeas, and so forth. Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, I think, in a sense, Hitler lives. Now, for the shocker of articles, I get so many every day, but this is one of the top ones, and I shouldn't have saved to the last, but I'll see if I can get it all in this time period, and I'll get the full story from a World Watcher in New York. I called him today out of Newsday. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle, and listen to this story. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North's Private Arms Network purchased 158 tons of rifles and ammunition for Nicaraguan rebels last year. He bought them from a reputed international narcotic smuggler and a terrorist linked to the hijackers of the liner Achille Lauro, sources said. It was printed in Newsday. Now, Michael Ledeen and Bettino Craxi, the Prime Minister of Italy, were involved in the Achille Lauro whole story that was going on at the time, as was Oliver North. And North was buying from a narcotic smuggler, narcotics, a terrorist linked to the Achille Lauro. The sources identified the arms dealer as Manzer Al-Kassar, a 42-year-old Syrian who reportedly supplied arms to Abul Abbas, the head of the Palestine Liberation Front unit, the mastermind of 1985 Achille Lauro hijacking and other radical Palestinian groups. Now, Abul Abbas was arrested in Italy after the hijacking of Achille Lauro, and the plane was directed by Oliver North and delivered to Bettino Craxi. Bettino Craxi released Abul Abbas, who was obviously working with North, and he was able to leave Italy and was not held at a trial. They found him guilty, of course, but they released him in Italy, and he is out at large, and he was, in fact, working with Oliver North and was the man behind the Achille Lauro hijacking, which I realized was a setup right from the very beginning, an agent provocateur action. Now, to continue with this article, the arms were purchased by a company linked to retired Air Force Major General Richard Secord again and his business associate, Albert Hakim. That comes out of Stanford Technology, the IIS, the beginning of the TCI, the Otto von Bolschwing Network. Of course, Secord and Hakim were involved with Abul Abbas. The arms were purchased from him, the man arrested for masterminding the Klinghoffer murder, the dumping of him in the wheelchair into the ocean. The whole Achille Lauro episode comes right out of Oliver North, Secord, and Hakim. Both men have figured prominently in the Iran-Contra scandal, goes on. The purchase of the arms from Al-Kassar was confirmed. Imagine, these are arms going to Nicaragua from a man who masterminded the Achille Lauro. They're giving him business and money, probably paying him 10 times the price of the arms to pay off for the Achille Lauro story. The purchase of the arms from Al-Kassar was confirmed by congressional investigators probing the Iran-Contra affair. Wow. A retired intelligence officer said that Al-Kassar family, which includes several brothers, is reputed to be the largest drug and arms-dealing family in Syria. Now watch that link to Henry Arsan and the Steve Baum operation out of the Vatican, out of Banco Ambrosiano, that links to Arsan and the Syrian connections, and because these same operatives all worked as a team, and the names keep running in and out of each one of these affairs. The article goes on, a United States criminal record document labels him, Ali Kassar, and the family, of course, and this great terrorist, Abul Abbas, with a large capital letter terrorist at the top of the page. It claims he has alleged ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine controlled by Dr. George Habash. Now go back to the article I did for Hustler magazine in February 1984, where there's a picture of Larry McDonald in the center, and I designed a Larry McDonald pie with seven parts to show you the importance of Western Goals under the persona of Larry McDonald. Then Western Goals was turned over to Carl Spitz Channel in Washington, and five members of the board of Western Goals are on the board of Accuracy and Media. And Carl Spitz Channel, of course, is directly linked with Oliver North and John Singlaub, one of those members of Western Goals. And one piece of the pie, I referred to Robert Byron Watson's affidavit to the House Select Committee on Assassinations involving the murders of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, and the name of George Habash from Lebanon, the Atlanta, Georgia connections to the assassination, and his brother Fuad Habash are the links to ITT, to Colonia Dignidad, to General Augusto Pinochet in Chile, and the Nazi connections in Chile. Habash is part of this story. The sources familiar with the transaction said that Ali Kassar acted as the middleman for the deal. He purchased the arms, now listen to this, from Cenzin, C-E-N-Z-I-N, the Polish government agency that controls foreign trade, and sold them to North's group. Now, I have about five different Polish or Eastern European arms agencies that are sending, like, weapons, Soviet weapons, Eastern weapons, down to Central America and all over the world. So when they're found, like with the Achille Lauro, in one newspaper, they refer to a Soviet-made AK-47 assault rifle. That was in the Houston Post, June 24, 1986, at the time of the trial. They sell the Soviet weapons and leave them so that when Mr. Klinghoffer is dead, you see Soviet weapons, and they're being sent out of Poland from this group, the Cenzin group. Details of buying and selling prices and financial arrangements cannot be learned, but this is a story that just broke. When the trial was going on for these particular terrorists, I have many articles on them, one from the San Francisco Chronicle, June 20th, and it tells about a man, one of the defendants in this trial, a defiant person who confessed to murdering a disabled New York City man during the Achille Lauro crime. His name is Yosef Magid Al-Molki, M-O-L-Q-I. I'm sure I didn't pronounce it right. But Molki said at first he said he did the murders, but he repeatedly told the judge that neither he nor the other three hijackers committed the murder. They insisted Klinghoffer's death was a game between the Syrians and the Americans. This echoed statements by Mohammed Abul Abbas, and that's the man who works with Oliver North getting weapons down to Nicaragua and through this operation, and also was the man behind the Achille Lauro. This statement was echoed by Mohammed Abul Abbas, the leader of the PIA, Palestine Liberation Organization, who was accused of having ordered and directed the hijacking. Abbas has maintained that Klinghoffer died of natural causes. His body was taken to Syria after the hijacking. Later, the autopsy showed the gunshots to the chest and head. But the defendant, Mr. Molki, was saying that it was his death, Klinghoffer's death, was a game between the Syrians and the Americans. Another article in the Houston Post, besides the fact of the assault weapon being a Russian weapon, goes into the death of Klinghoffer and how he was wheeled over to the terrorists by a man, a Portuguese steward. And I wonder, because of the strong links of William Casey and Richard Allen and Frank Carlucci and Oliver North and Singlaub and Hakim shipping weapons to Central America through Portugal, if this wasn't just one other witness or person just happening to be on the ship who delivers the wheelchair and the gentleman to the people who were going to shoot him and throw him over the side. The New York Times, July the 11th, has another article that Mr. Mulkey and his three defendants were arrested in Sicily after an Egyptian airline carrying them from Cairo was forced to land by United States Navy planes. That was the Oliver North operation. And then the article goes on to say that Mr. Abbas and his colleagues then were released and set free. The Italian government let them go free. His colleagues were taken out of Italy. And, of course, there was quite a bit of complaint about it. It lasted all of about 2 hours and was ignored. And Abbas and his deputies, even though they were found guilty, they're not in the country at all in Italy. And they fled elsewhere. And they referred to the fact that this whole hijacking was what they a political ploy. And it's interesting, the terms that they use as if they're doing it for America. My time is running out, so I can't do more. I'll do more on Oliver North and the hijacking and Bettino Craxi and Michael Ledeen, hopefully next week. In the meantime, not enough time. We'll have to get back to it next week. This is Mae Brussel, and I'll be sharing these and other facts with you and World Watchers. And thanks again for all the books and articles you've been sending.